Our sun is headed into solar maximum, the period of greatest activity in its solar cycle. My name is Troy Klein, and welcome to the new podcast series called Space Weather Living History. During this series, you'll hear directly from the people who for years have been studying the evolution of space weather, how we make observations, and our capabilities to predict space weather events. Now, every 11 years on average, our sun reaches a peak period of activity called solar maximum. That's followed a few years later by a period of quiet called solar minimum. During solar maximum, there are many sunspots, solar flares, and coronal mass ejections, all of which can affect communications and technology here on Earth. Now, the energy from those solar blasts can disrupt radio communications, upset electrical power systems, damage satellites and change their orbits, cause navigational equipment to make mistakes, and even endanger astronauts walking in space. The effects from these solar storms can be far-reaching. In fact, they can have impacts throughout our entire solar system. These conditions are what we refer to as space weather. Sound exciting? Let's get right to the next interview.
I am Ernest Hildner. I am retired. I was for 19 years the director of the space weather component of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It had several name changes, Space Environment Laboratory to more recently Space Weather Prediction Center. In that capacity, I was overseeing the research that NOAA did on space weather and the daily forecasts and the real-time alerts when something happened that were produced by the center. In addition, I assisted with defining the instruments that would fly on NOAA's geostationary and polar orbiting spacecraft, principally flown for meteorological and climatological purposes. And I worked very closely with NSF and with the NASA's Office of Solar and Heliospheric Physics to optimize what we could do and how we could best utilize research, observations, and understandings for operations. And the WIND spacecraft is a wonderful example of that. Where I worked with Dick Fisher so that we could, NOAA could get antennas around the world to track wind in real time, and a very low bitrate channel was added to wind so that it could send down real-time information to these spacecraft, whereas the high-rate science information came down to NASA antennas at a few space places around the world. And eventually, on subsequent spacecraft, we worked with NASA so that a subset of the science data, when it came down to the NASA tracking stations, would immediately flow into the NOAA system and be available to the forecasters. So the connection between NASA, NSF, and NOAA was very tight and I think mutually beneficial, so that the research had benefits to taxpayers, tangible financial benefit to the taxpayers, and the university research funded by NSF had payoffs. My primary research interest, and it's in the past tense because I'm now retired, my primary research interest was in the solar corona and then moving out into the interplanetary medium and then the consequences here at Earth. And my initial research for my PhD was in how quiescent prominences form. And then I got into the Skylab world, so became quite fascinated with coronal mass ejections And one of the fascinating things about that was that nobody had ever seen the corona like that before. Eclipses were so rare, and artificial eclipses from the Earth's surface were so bothered by sky brightness that when we made artificial eclipses from space with the black sky, we suddenly, and had routine monitoring of the sun, we saw phenomena that some people had imagined and speculated and hypothesized about, but they could not prove, and we were the first to, our experiment team was the first to actually see and verify and discover things that nobody had thought of in the corona. And that was a whole lot of fun. Well, you build a telescope and you put you build a telescope and you put a disc in the front that blocks out where the sun would be, and you very carefully center the telescope on the sun. You have to dump the sun's heat, but then you look at the faint atmosphere around the sun called the corona. And what we saw were these ejections from the sun that simply had not been seen before. There were some ground-based measurements taking scans around the sun of brightness that saw depletions, but they didn't know whether that material had fallen back into the sun or whether it had actually been blown out into interplanetary space. And of course, when the Earth is in the line of fire of one of these explosions coming out from these blobs of material coming out from the sun, then that's when we have these space weather effects here on Earth. And so it was brand new stuff, and it was very exciting to be part of the Skylab team, because another set of instruments on board were the X-ray telescopes, and because the Earth's atmosphere absorbs X-rays, you can't see astronomical objects in X-rays from the ground. You have to go to space. And we saw coronal holes for the first time. And M regions, that so named because there were recurring magnetic storms, were understood to exist on the sun, but nobody knew what they were until Skylab saw the coronal holes. That wasn't our instrument, but since we were sitting at tables next to each other, and since we operated as a unit, then it was also extremely exciting to see this brand new phenomenon that explained something that people had puzzled about for 40 years. A coronal hole got named that because when you look at the sun in X-rays, where there is more material, the sun is brighter. And the very first images that came back from the sun showed that there were regions that were dark. It looked like you were looking down into a hole instead of the fluffy solar corona visible in X-rays elsewhere. You were just looking right down to the surface of the sun, which is so cold that it doesn't emit X-rays. So it turns out that these are regions sort of like the part in your hair where the magnetic field lines that come up and permeate the atmosphere of the sun start to go, say, to the left on one side and to the right on the other side, and down the middle they are straight up, or they are not coming back and lying back down onto the sun the way the hairs do on your head, either side of the part in your hair. The result is that the hot solar atmosphere finds it very easy to escape in that region. It's not bound by those closed magnetic fields, those loops of magnetic field, but rather it can come straight out. It spends no time near, or very little time, near the surface of the sun, and so the density of the material there is much lower, and that's why it's dark, and that's why we call them coronal holes. But it's almost like fire hoses in that those regions, fire hoses of materials streaming outward from the sun very rapidly. The sun, it rotates every 28 days. Think of a fire hose coming out from the sun, and it sweeps by under the sub-Earth point, and then 2 or 3 days later, the material that the fire hose nozzle was squirting finally arrives at the Earth. So it's making spirals around in the interplanetary medium, but eventually that material comes out and hits Earth and causes geomagnetic disturbances and aurorae and all the other phenomena that space weather cause. Yeah, Skylab was exciting times. I was an experiment scientist on the coronagraph, but as I say, the five instruments, the five telescopes that we had worked together, and we had cooperative observing plans so that we operated the telescopes jointly to try to answer specific solar questions. And then I moved on to become the chief of the solar physics branch at Marshall Space Flight Center for 5 years. And then I came to Boulder and became the director of what was then the Space Environment Center, where NOAA was doing operational space weather forecasting. So my personal involvement was in research was pretty much with the Skylab era, and then trying to understand solar magnetic fields better when I went down to Marshall. They had a solar magnetograph, and then being the director of a research outfit at NOAA trying to improve the space weather forecasts. Skylab was transformational in quite a number of ways. In 1968, NOAA had started to make daily predictions of flare probabilities and geomagnetic storm probabilities, but those were pretty crude. And the Skylab project was so well funded that NOAA got enough money to set up a worldwide observatory network to keep the sun under continuous observation in visible light and bring those results back to one location, actually two locations, one in Boulder at the home location and one down in Houston during Skylab to help with the operations of Skylab. We changed the observing program. This was novel. This was transformational. Every day with a teletype message based on what the sun was doing. And there was a huge wrangle over that because NASA had been involved in shorter missions before, and every minute of the astronauts' time, what they would be doing during a day was in fact scripted before the rocket ever left the ground. And this was very new and uncomfortable to the flight controllers that they would allow a bunch of long-haired, crazy, sandal-wearing, hippie scientists tell the astronauts what they'd be doing tomorrow on a day-by-day basis. And that was just a cultural shift for NASA. But the result was that, one, we had a worldwide network of observatories. Two, we had brand new, never before available observations of the sun, and we had those data coming down in real time. And the understandings that developed after Skylab shut down were, as I say, transformational in many ways to the understanding of space weather. The other thing that Skylab, although they were aware a little bit of the radiation hazard of sending astronauts to the moon and back, those are still pretty short trips. Putting guys up for 3 months at a time, you got to worry about solar flares and the energetic particles. And so suddenly there's a whole radiation health component that NASA got interested in doing research and trying to understand the space weather aspects of that. And now, of course, that's hugely important if we're ever going to go to Mars, because that's such a long mission. The first key turning point in space weather, to my mind, although the phenomena weren't called space weather at that time, was during World War II, when the high-frequency HF radio communications were seen to be disrupted and connected with the phenomena on the sun. The mechanisms weren't clear, but the correlation was very clear. And so each military force had its own little research unit, which was forced then in the propagation laboratory, part then of the National Bureau of Standards, when it moved to Boulder, Colorado. But ever since then, the government has had a, well before NASA was formed, a research component in looking into space weather. As near as I can remember, space weather wasn't, there are several references using that term in the literature earlier, but it never caught on until George Sisko, then a meteorology professor in the meteorology department at the University of California, Los Angeles, started using the term in his public talks and papers. And then that got people realizing that it wasn't just a research effort like an astronomical or astrophysical research, but actually it had application. Like meteorological research has application to what people actually feel and are influenced by. So that was the first. And then, as I said, Skylab came along and really galvanized everything, both with money and with understanding. I was trying to remember when NASA started up the Living with a Star program, but that name is absolute genius. Anybody who hears it says, what does that mean? And living with our star, you've got to adapt to its angry moments. And that's different, and that got people thinking about the consequences of space weather. Another huge turning point was when NASA launched the Wind spacecraft, so we actually could see and get data about coronal mass ejections headed toward Earth. As I think I said earlier, if it's rare that Earth is in the line of fire of a coronal mass ejection. Usually they go off into some other part of the interplanetary medium. But so you don't know, in fact, when you see a coronal mass ejection, whether or not it's going to hit Earth. So having a sensor upstream 1 hour then enables you to say, to switch from a alert to a real warning that it's about to hit. Take action if it will help. And so Wind, still up there, still operating, it has been a wonderful turning point. I think another turning point from my mind, and you are, of course, getting the perspective of a guy who's been in operations, who's very interested in how space weather improves so it helps customers, as well as how it improves intellectually in terms of the research and understanding. But another huge, along those lines, another huge jump forward was, I think, the Wang Shili RG model that actually was the first to try to use the observed characteristics of a CME near the sun and predict how strong the effect would be at Earth. Now, it's been superseded by the NLIL model that Dušan Ostrosil and his colleagues have developed, which is an even better three-dimensional model with MHD. But that both of those, the one following on the other one by 15 years, were just wonderful. And the stereo spacecraft have done a wonderful job of getting different views of what's going on at the sun. And when they got around to 90 degrees from the sun-Earth line, then they could actually see the coronal mass ejections that were about to hit Earth. And otherwise, we have had to infer from observations near the Earth's sun line which ones were going to hit Earth, but they got very good observations of what was going to happen. You're absolutely right that the more we learn about space weather, and the better becomes our ability to predict it and its consequences, and as the world becomes more technologically dependent upon things like GPS and the electric power grid that are affected by space weather, then it's certainly not a solved problem by any stretch of the imagination. If in anything, it should have growing emphasis as we go forward. In addition to the research side of space weather, there's a whole organizational and administrative component to advancing space weather research and operations. And that has gradually grown in many ways, and there are some big turning points there, some milestones. You first have a voice crying in the wilderness, "This is important, listen to me." And then over time, that Messiah attracts followers, and they start to spread the message, and eventually there is enough realization that people are willing to organize themselves into cooperative ventures and to seek funding for increased activity in this area. And again, Skylab was transformational in that it showed the need and the value, and suddenly, within a decade after Skylab, a huge understanding of what was going on, so that space weather products for affected users were much more useful. And that, of course, fed back so that there were more people doing that, interested in space weather. And then in 1994, there was a meeting held with Bob Correll, then director of geosciences at NSF, and George Sisko pitched the idea that there should be a national space weather program, a national space weather service, in fact, is what it was called in an article by Sisko. George Lotko, Lou Lanzarotti, Ernie Hildner, and Rich Behnke in EOS in 1994, and that actually led to the National Space Weather Program. Seven agencies in the United States government organized under the Office of the Federal Coordinator for Meteorology, because there was no other place to put it, so space weather, let's put it under meteorology. And that office's purpose within NOAA is to coordinate what all the agencies do in particular areas like hurricane research or drought research. And so we got space weather under that umbrella in 1994. And then in 1999, NOAA started holding what today is called Space Weather Week, which brought together the researchers, the operators that used the forecasts and the information, and the service providers, the forecasters, and about 250 people showed up, and it has grown almost every year since then, and over 350 people showed up at the most recent one in 2013, but it has been a continuing vibrant forum for the users to say what they need, the researchers to say, well, we could provide something like this if there's any demand for it, and the forecasters listening to both sides and saying, okay, we can make a product that has validity and that is useful, and we will modify or add what we do to take advantage of the new knowledge and serve people with new needs. So then another huge milestone was the establishment, and I'm trying to remember when that was, in the early 2000s, of the CCMC, the Community Modeling Center, Cooperative Community Modeling Center, which is at Goddard Space Flight Center, and there people can submit their models for testing, and if they survive the testing, then users can run those models in real time to see what their predictions of space weather are and how, if they relate well to reality, then they can use those in what they do. It is intended, or was originally intended, to be a validation effort so that these could go into these models, this new understanding could go into daily operations. Finally, I would say that a major turning point in the acceptance, if you will, of space weather is the fact that the Space Environment Center fully joined and became a part of, a full part of the National Weather Service, the nation's meteorological service, in 2005, which made the American Meteorological Society, not just the American Geophysical Union, be interested in space weather, and at the national annual meeting of the American Meteorological Society, there has now started to be, since then, a major component of space weather. And so the meteorologists, both the broadcast meteorologists on TV, the meteorology departments at universities, and other folks who would not have been exposed to space weather particularly, now at their own society's national convention, see the emphasis that is given to space weather. So there's been a whole governmental and public acceptance of space weather that has gone on at the same time as the research side, driven largely by NASA and NSF, have developed a better understanding of space weather.
I hope you enjoyed the Space Weather Living History podcast brought to you by NASA's Sun Earth Days program. You can learn more about the Space Weather Living History Project on our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov. And don't forget to join our growing community of Facebook and Twitter fans for the latest information and facts about the new Sun Earth Day themes. For all other details about these programs, including information about our past Sun Earth Days themes, be sure to visit our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov.